Welcome all. Beginning of a new year. I think you will have all received your program for 2021. Thanks to Maria for sending that out and sharing. If you don't have that program, can you please see Maria afterwards? And if you want to go on our distribution list, just give her your email address so that you can. For those that I haven't met, Joe Hawander, I'm Chair of the Engineer Charitable Trust that we partner with the City Library in hosting these sessions. We run these February through November each year, and we've been doing it now for, 7 or 8 years, I'm losing count. But as you can see from the program that you have received, we've got a great program lined up for this year. Now the aim is really to continue on with military heritage, not only of military heritage in Palmerston North, but also to concentrate on commemoration. So in particular, this year being the 80th anniversary of World War II, we're going to focus on quite a number of World War II campaigns, battles and such like, but also get other service representation. So it's not just a brown job, all the army stuff. We get the blue jobs and the white jobs and whoever else you might consider as well. Also, we look back at some of our early history with the New Zealand Land Wars, and we'll be talking about those later on. I just make sure before I introduce Aaron to you, one thing that we will be doing this year is, over the April-May period, is cranking up a small display in those display cabinets behind you, the horizontal display cabinets, over the April-May period to concentrate on, again, the 80th anniversary of what occurred in 1941, so that we've got Greece, we've got Crete, and we've also got North Africa with Operation Crusader right throughout that 1941 period. And then each year we'll roll that over. So next year we'll look at what went on in 1942 and so on right through to 2025. As part of our commemorations. The other thing to mention is with the sesquicentennial for Palmerston North occurring this year, there are a number of presentations, both our midday and our evening ones, focusing on the history of Palmerston North, particularly the military history and those things associated with the things like the places like Awatuni Racecourse, Showgrounds, Murray Battalion Hall and so on. So more information will come out on that in due course. So without further ado, can I introduce to you Dr. Aaron Fox, a New Zealand military historian, who's come dressed for Parliament today, but he obviously didn't get the message from the Speaker of the House saying, you know, ties are optional. But thanks for getting all tied up, Aaron. Much appreciated.
Can I take it off now?
yeah, by all means. Feel comfortable. We had Aaron down to talk about the Battle for Crete last year in May to coincide with the 79th anniversary. But of course, COVID hit us. So we put it off and then tried again in August. And then COVID hit us again. So third time lucky. We're great to greet Aaron here today. So over to you, Aaron.
It's after midday, so Kali Spera, everybody, as they would say in Crete today. Good afternoon. Thank you, Joe, for that introduction. And yes, third time lucky. Fingers crossed that everything works this afternoon as I talk to you about the Battle of Crete. This is by way of a following on from a promise I made after my last talk, which was on the life and times of Brigadier James Hargis, still completing his biography. And one of his seminal battles was the Battle of Crete in 1941. But I talked so much last time, I said, look, we'll have to return to the Battle of Crete at another time. Here we are today, 80th anniversary year of the Battle of Crete. And in particular, where's the button pushed? That one. Right. It's also worth recognising that when we talk about Crete, there's a very strong Manawatu II component to the battle itself. So let's have a look quickly at some personalities I will come back to in the course of my presentation today, starting from the top left corner. There's Andrew, born in Ashurst, a regular officer, served in World War I, won the Victoria Cross, and in 1940 took command of the 22nd Battalion, which is sourced from the Wellington Military District, known as Old February, a stern disciplinarian, old February, because his usual punishment was 28 days for any infringement. Next to him, George Dittmer from, I have to look this one up, Maharahara, just up the road, another regular soldier, served in World War I. By 1940, he's given command of 28th Maori Battalion, which forms here in Palmerston North in 1940 for service overseas. Next to him, Bull Hanson, Frederick Horowhenua Hanson, born in Levin, educated at Tanui, just up the road. He, in 1940, was commanding the New Zealand Engineers. He was CRE on Crete. Down below, far left court, far left corner to me, far right for you, Geoffrey Cox, Geoffrey Sandford Cox, probably one of our greatest exports of the 20th century, probably the most famous New Zealander you've never heard of, later Sir Geoffrey Cox, born in Palmerston North, grew up in Invercargill, my hometown, and later a Rhodes Scholar, became a journalist, reported on the Spanish Civil War, reported on the Russo-Finnish War, was in Paris in 1940 when the Germans invaded, escaped to England, joined up with the New Zealand Expeditionary Force. Being proficient in languages, he ended up in May 1941 as General Freiberg's intelligence officer on Crete. And next to him, Keith Elliott from Apiti, educated Fielding Agricultural High School. 1941, he's in the 22nd Battalion on Crete. The following year, wins the Victoria Cross. But let's get back to Crete. May 1941, good God, I've got the wrong date there. That is not an auspicious start. Let's ignore that. It's May 1941. I was doing this at work yesterday, so I had to hide what I was doing occasionally, but don't report that. Anyway, the German evaluation of the battle on the second day was that it was on a knife edge. The battle could have gone either way. The mountain troopers said that a heavy, concentrated British counterattack would cause the defenders, the Germans, to fight for their life. It was the first mass airborne invasion attempted, and its outcome was never certain from the outset. It was a gamble on all sides, and in fact it was marked by haste, as you all see. Hasty preparations, hasty defensive arrangements. But I like to think of it as the irresistible force versus the immovable object. The irresistible force being the German airborne forces, the paratroops. Highly trained, elite units, committed Nazis, many of them, well led by professional soldiers. And on the bottom left-hand corner, you'll see a little packet there, methamphetamine. So they were using crystal meth to help get the troops through the shock of battle at this point, through Blitzkrieg. So the airborne troops were aerial Blitzkrieg fighters. Against them on Crete were British Commonwealth troops in the main, supported by Greek troops, and especially the New Zealanders and the Australians, well proficient from World War I in digging trenches, holding positions, and then attacking with the Lee Enfield rifle and the bayonet. Those are the immovable objects, fueled in their case by army biscuits and bully beef. You'd want to kill anybody after eating that stuff, wouldn't you, really? I like to think of it too as a World War I battlefield tilted on its back. Defenders on the ground, the attackers coming from the sky. The advantages. On the German side, air superiority. As Brigadier Hargis said in 1941, every aircraft that came out of a Messerschmitt factory in Germany seemed to be flying over Crete. Technological advantage too that the Germans had, you can see them here in this image, fighting Fleet Air Arm Gloster Gladiators. So modern aircraft versus World War I era biplanes. And it's that superior technology and overwhelming force that the Germans had from the air, which was their principal advantage in 1941. The advantage the Allies had, one of the principal advantages, was what Churchill called the Golden Goose. The British had broken the German codes. I say Enigma, that's the machine that the Germans used, an unbreakable encoding machine, which the British managed to break with Polish help. And therefore, on the British side, it was called Ultra. It was the ultimate secret. They had the German battle plan, having from the Luftwaffe codes, before the battle starts. Now, that's a tremendous advantage when you're planning a defensive position. And it devolves down to the two commanders who were present at the time. On the left, Kurt Student. So he's the German commander. Let me just have a look. Born 1888, he served in World War I, got a reputation as a fighter pilot. He was one of the early Fokker pilots, I think he scored 6 or 8 victories on the Western Front, rose to the rank of colonel between the war, and he was an early convert of air power, and particularly glider-borne troops. So he helped establish the paratroopers from an early age, from the outset. Not only that, he was known as Papa to his troops, so he was their father. He enlisted them, trained them, and then put them into battle. 1941, he's commanding 11th Flieger Corps, so it's his battle. And he is adamant that airborne troops can take Crete. The Air Force can suppress the defenders, the airborne troops can drop on Crete and take the island in a very short time, and he convinces a very sceptical Hitler that this can't be done in very short notice. The order's given in April the 25th, Hitler gives the approval for the attack. By May the 20th, it's all on. So it's quite a scramble for the attackers to get their act together. On the other side, anybody recognise Tiny Freyberg? New Zealand divisional commander in World War II. A hero from the First World War, English born, grows up in New Zealand. And to cut a very long story short, distinguished at Gallipoli, distinguished on the Western Front, wins the Victoria Cross, becomes a professional soldier, has to leave the army in the 1930s because of an enlarged heart, and then returns to the military to command the New Zealand Division in 1940. Also devolves down to some of the commanders on each side. On the German side, the men were as tough as they looked. Here are some of the colonels from May 1941, left to right. Bramke, who was in command of the assault on Western Crete for the airfield at Malena. Sturm, who was responsible for the assault on the airfield at Retimon. And on the right, Bruno Brauer, who was responsible for the attack on Heraklion and the airfield there. They're not as formidable as they look. For instance, Brauer on the right was a little short bloke who stammered. Had a stammer. Going back to the previous slide, Student was notable for speaking very slowly, so slowly, in fact, that Goering used to joke about it. Oh, God, you know, he spit it out and he's talking again. We'll come back tomorrow when he's finished, sort of thing. Rutger's troops commit atrocities after the battle. Sturm is notable for being captured by the Greeks and surviving, even as a German officer, and refusing to be put in a compound with his men. He wanted his own separate little prison camp. Brauer was the most humane of the three, became the commandant of Crete. During his occupation, the Cretan population wasn't as oppressed as they were under other commanders on Crete, but that didn't save him. He was executed for war crimes after World War II. He's actually buried on Crete. His body was taken there. There were mountain troopers as well on the German side. Julius Wengel there on the left, committed Nazi. He'd been in the Austro-Hungarian army in World War I, and then through the interwar period, like all the other German commanders, had been a professional soldier and helped develop these new fighting units, whether they're Luftwaffe, whether they're paratroops, or in this case, mountain troops. His favourite saying, sweat saves blood. Therefore, the more you march, the more you can outmaneuver the other side, the better it is for you. On the Allied side, on the New Zealand side, there we have, well, just one other thought about Julius Wengel. He was also known by his troops as Papa. So he had that, again, that fatherly figure. He was a fatherly figure to his troops. There's Puttick, Edward Puttick, another professional soldier, very good as a quartermaster, very good as an administrator. Had served with some success in Greece in 1941, commanding a brigade of New Zealand troops, 4 Brigade. But in Crete, his command is put to the test when he takes over the New Zealand Division, or what there is of it on Crete, and responsibility for running for the course of the battle, the command of the battle in the New Zealand sectors. He is found wanting. His nickname is the Red Hun. And obviously he's commanding New Zealand troops. I know those are Australians on the photograph, but we'll just pretend they're Anzacs for a second. And what he's got to look after on Crete are sort of the remnants, if you like, or the rump of the New Zealand division. They've been fighting in Greece, a short, sharp campaign against the Germans. They have lost their transport, they have lost their heavy equipment, they have lost most of their signal equipment. They've arrived on Crete with what they can hold. And as you saw in one of the early photographs, that's the Enfield rifle and a shovel. And that really is how the defence develops. My favourite Australian commander is Brigadier Vasey at the time, Major General Vasey. And he's a Duntroon graduate, professional Australian soldier, served in World War I and then in Australia and in India. The previous month in Greece, when he's getting his troops set up, my favourite comment that he says, well, look, here you are and here you're going to bloody well stay. And if any bloody German gets between your post and the neighbouring post, take your bloody Bren gun, turn it around on him and shoot him in the ass. Tough men. General Eugen Meindl on the left was the commander of operations at Malemay, and Tavranitis will come to that very shortly. He is opposed on the New Zealand side by the subject of my biography, Brigadier James Hargest. Eugen Meindl, we don't think of him very much, but he's a fascinating character. If nothing else, he competed in the Olympics, track and field, and served through the First World War. And by World War II, by 1940, as a successful army commander, he's then transferred to paratroops, and the first time he ever jumps out of an aircraft is straight into the middle of the Battle of Narvik. That's his very first parachute jump, and he's in battle. That's in 1940. Come 1941, he's in the thick of it again, and jumps with his troops over the airfield at near the airfield at Malemay in Tavranitis. Hargest, on the other hand, another soldier who has come through the First World War, and he's not a professional soldier in the interwar period. He's a territorial commander for 10 years, and otherwise he's developed a successful career as a politician. 1936 helps form the National Party. So by the time he arrives in Crete in 1941, yes, he is a seasoned New Zealand officer. Yes, he was brave and courageous in the First World War. He's very good at commanding men. But for 10 years, he's been a politician in Wellington. So he has that aspect of him as well. So the New Zealand government puts extra faith in him as a politician and not just as a commander. Well, the Germans keep being called Papa, don't they? The reason for that is that the generation who served in the First World War are now commanding their son's generation in the Second World War. There is something in that. So that they're fatherly figures as much as men sending younger men into battle. Certainly James Hargest feels that in 1941. Freiburg has his son on Crete. Interestingly, the son is sent off for officer training just before the Battle of Crete begins. And I think Hargest had a hand in that. Duggan was the New Zealand Chief of General Staff. His son is in the battle, and he's captured during the battle. And far right there, even James Hargest had a son in the military, and he dies of wounds in 1944. Just a thought. Why Crete? Well, let's have a look at the geopolitical idea. Just a few minutes on the bigger picture of the war in 1941. And I'll step away from the microphone and try and bellow at you, because I'd like to point at the screen. You can think of it by January 1941, a lot of Europe is under dictatorship, whether it's fascist Italy, Nazi Germany, which has come along and seized France, or the Soviet Union under Stalin, which has sort of a neutral, a non-aggression pact with Germany at this point. Where the fighting is happening is round at the periphery. There are diplomatic battles going on. Adolf Hitler would like to bring Spain into the Axis camp. He's trying to get the Spanish to sign up to become allied with the Italians and the Japanese. There are German troops already in Bulgaria, so that's going to go to the Axis side at some stage. Hitler's also making overtures to Yugoslavia and saying, come in with us. We're the winners. We're in Europe. Come in with the big good guys. And the Yugoslavs are likewise saying, we're just not sure of that whole business, no. By February 1941, things are changing. The Italians, bless them, in October 1940, have tried to attack the Greeks. And much to everyone's surprise, especially the Italians, they fail. And the Greeks have been holding them on the Albanian border very successfully. In part because of the division from Crete, Grecian troops, are actually fighting up here in northern Greece against the Italians. There's also fighting going on here in Libya. This is Italian-occupied Libya, and the British have managed to get into Cyrenaica, and they're pushing the Italians and knocking them around considerably. They're also fighting in East Africa. Hitler has made the decision to support the Italians. He sent a unit which is going to be called the Afrika Korps under this German General Rommel to North Africa, to Libya, or Tunisia, and then they're heading off to Libya, and they're actually going to support the Italian effort. And he also decides to get in behind the Italians here. Blow Yugoslavia, let's sort that out, let's invade them. Let's get down to Greece, let's sort that out, take the Peloponnese. And so within, by April 1941, the situation has changed. German troops are operating in Libya, pushing the British back. German troops are from Yugoslavia down to Greece and have pushed the British off the mainland. And really, at this point, the British are reduced to island strongholds, Crete, Malta, Gibraltar, and of course, Great Britain. There, so that's sort of 1941. Bigger picture stuff is that the Germans are getting prepared to attack Russia in June. The Japanese are getting ready to attack Pearl Harbor and their greater Southeast Asian co-prosperity sphere in December. So there are bigger things afoot in behind what we're talking at today. But here, Crete, by end of April 1941, is tactically and strategically becoming more and more significant. The British post here on Malta is a damn nuisance for anyone trying to fly supplies over to North Africa. Likewise, Crete could become a useful staging post for German supplies coming across into North Africa as well, and they're looking at Egypt. Takes a while for people to realise how important Crete can be. The British have messed around for almost a year. They started off with Crete, of course Greece was neutral at that time. By February 1941, the British have decided to get in behind the Greek war effort and help it on the Greek mainland. So the British are very interested in the harbour at Suda Bay, an anchorage, then it develops into a harbour, then it develops into a defensive harbour, and then to support that, the Royal Air Force creates airfields at Maleme, Retimon, Heraklion, airfields on the northern part of the Greek of the Cretan island facing the mainland Europe. And by April 1941, it's decided that no longer should the British sort of have a little base here, but this should become a fortified island. From the German point of view, of course, they say, well, look, the Allies are on here. We've knocked them out of Greece in a very short period of time. Let's look at Crete. And a student says, with my paratroops, they can do anything. Let us attack the island. Let us swamp it with aircraft. Let's reduce the defenders around Maleme, Galatas, Hania, Retimon, Heraklion. With all the aircraft, let's keep their heads down. And as the day progresses on the 20th of May, let's swap them with our paratroopers. And then we will bring in further troops by air once the airfields are secured. We can fly them in and we can bring them by sea. Didn't quite work out that way, but that was the essential battle plan. As I said, Hitler was very sceptical that was going to work, but he was convinced by Student to give it a go. It's interesting that the commanders at the time, Freyberg is on Crete, of course. He has a lookout above a quarry in the Akrotiri Peninsula, so that's further around the coast from Hania. Student is in considerable comfort in Athens. He's taken over the magnificently named Hotel Great Britain, the Hotel Gran Bretagne. So he's in considerable comfort, and he can do that, as you'll see shortly, thanks to the Germans' outstanding signals communications. He can control the battle remotely. He ends up controlling a battle remotely, the way it develops. So like I said, it's shock and awe. The Germans thought they could come in, bomb the daylights out of the defenders, reduce them, and take them prisoner very quickly and suppress them with the paratroops. They didn't know that their battle plan had already been deciphered by the Allies, and that Freyberg already had the whole battle plan there in front of him before the 20th of May. To the technicalities, of course, the Germans needed to get their troops on the ground as quickly as possible from about 8 a.m. on May the 20th. So their idea was they'd use troop transports, the venerable Junkers Ju-52, Tanti U, or Iron Annie, corrugated metal bodywork on it. So it carried up to 13 troops. The disadvantage they had is that on the bomb racks under the aircraft, that's where the weapons were carried. So you drop the troops, you drop the supply canisters with the weapons, the troops hit the ground, have to organise, find their canisters, get their weapons, get into battle. That's a lesson the Americans learnt from Normandy in 1944, Americans and British alike. When you jump, have your weapons with you. Because everything can go wrong between the few seconds when you're jumping out of the aircraft, the 8 seconds or so, and hitting the ground. You can be hundreds of metres apart. If you're being shot at, that's quite a considerable thing to consider. They hadn't experienced this problem really before, because paratroop operations up to 1941 had been notably successful, especially in 1940 in Belgium, Fort Abenamel, where the Germans dropped the paratroops and they suppressed the defenders in no time flat. Textbook operation. They also operated gliders, carry 9 troops, with all the equipment. And so that's the belt and braces approach. You drop your paratroops, but you also have your attack troops coming in on gliders, and so they can land as close to the objective as possible and rush out and again subdue it. Nice idea. After that, of course, once the airfields are seized, as I mentioned, then the German mountain troops and the remaining paraforces could be flown in into the airfields or brought by sea. So on the 20th of May, as I said, first assault here, the most complete airfield down by the sea is at Malene, and then the partially formed airfields at Retimon and now Heraklion. In fact, that's the main airport now for Crete. So the main assault comes here from 8 o'clock, then develops in Retimon and Heraklion later in the day. It's fair to say that all of the assaults are suppressed by the defenders. Retimon, the Australians managed to suppress the assaulting troops very effectively. Same at Heraklion, the British troops there give the Germans a very hard time. German forces landing here in Prison Valley, likewise, sort of cut off from everybody else. And it's here at Malene where the fighting is probably the heaviest and the fiercest, and this is where the knife edge develops, right? An attempt by the Germans to bring in extra troops by sea is destroyed on the evening of the 21st of May, and into the morning of the 22nd, they're intercepted by the British and essentially blown out of the water. Now, most of the troops actually survive. They're picked up, but the Germans don't attempt that again during the Battle of Crete. They don't have enough ships. As it is, the fleet they've used are cobbled together Greek fishing boats that they've found in the ports. On the Allied side, I'll concentrate on the New Zealand sector around Malene, because I mean that's what I'm most familiar with. You can see here that Brigadier Hargest, Platanius, has put his troops together to try and counter the airborne invasion here at the airfield and the predicted seaborne invasion with those craft coming from Greece. So he's got the 22nd Battalion with Old February here, South Island Battalion here, 23rd Battalion, 28th Maori Battalion here, and the remnants of the Auckland Battalion, which had been knocked around quite badly in Greece and lost their commander as a result, now under a new commander. So the idea here is to defend the airfield, but also have troops available to move either to the sea or to support the airfield as determined, as the battle develops. Good in theory. In practice on the ground, for those of you who have been to Crete will know, there's the view from Hargest's headquarters at Platanius over to Hill 107. Malene Airfield is down here, and the battalions that you saw are actually dispersed in the ground, in this nice flat ground between the two elevations of Platanius and Hill 107. And about 2,700 troops spread over 5 miles. It's worth observing that by the end of the first day of battle, all of these olive groves and orange orchards are covered in German parachutes. And then each of those parachutes probably concealed a body. The German troops are actually decimated on that first day. And as Hargest looked back, you could see this. It was like a deadly bloom of flowers all the way across. Because what no one had really considered, one was that the New Zealanders are very good shots. That New Zealanders faced with something like duck shooting when the Germans are dropping out of the aircraft and have several seconds, up to 8 seconds, to drop to the ground. They're sitting targets, or they're floating targets. Aim at the feet, you'll hit them in the chest or the head. Also the previous year, during the Battle of Britain, Hargest and 5 Brigade plus other New Zealand troops had been in England, preparing to defend the English coast from, wait for it, German paratroop operations and German seaborne troops in the event of the German invasion of England. So they'd already gone through anti-paratroop training. They were already aware of German paratroop doctrine. They were already ready to fight this sort of battle. But not totally ready, because Hargest himself, the night before the battle, this is on the 19th of May 1941, did say, "I don't know what lies ahead." He made these comments to Geoffrey Cox, who we've seen earlier. "I don't know what lies ahead. I only know that it produces in me a sensation I never knew in the last war." And Hargest used to lead from the front, in front of the trenches, from 1915 onwards. So it wasn't fear. It was something quite different, something I can only describe as dread. Because for all their preparations, for all their knowledge, they still had just what they stood up with, stood in to fight. Basically the rifle, some machine guns, some artillery, and raw courage. He also knew that there were a few problems within his units. Command and control. So command. Hargest's 5 Brigade had 4 battalions. It was a large brigade. Infantry Brigade, had the 21st Battalion from Auckland, and had been under Polly Mackey. And as I say, Peter Wood was going to be able to tell us better than I could. They came to some grief in Greece the previous month. 22nd Battalion from the Wellington region, commanded by Les Andrew, saw the successes of Malone's Wellington Company on Chunuk Bia, Wellington Infantry Battalion. The 23rd Battalion from the South Island, commanded by a succession, well, let's say National Party officials. There's that political connection, come to that shortly. And the 28th Ngāri Battalion, which is both a blessing and a curse for the commander, because they carry the mana of the Māori nation into battle with the blessing of Sir Apirana Nata and others. And so Hargest has to look after them like a mother defending her young. He's quite chary about, especially 28th Ngāri Battalion, worried about them in Greece, keeps them close to him in Crete. Also has to be said that the commanders, you've met Les Andrew already, old February, regular force officer, you've met Dittmer, regular force officer, I think they get on all right. There seems to be some friction, especially with the South Island commander at the time, Leckie, here, he's supposed to support 22nd Battalion, that doesn't happen when it's supposed to. Now he's a teacher from Makariwa. He's a veteran of the First World War. He served in Palestine with the Mounted Rifles. And he's also a National Party official. Hargest is a National Party politician from Southland. Make of that what you will. Allen, who's taken over command of the 21st Battalion, or what's left of him, he's a National Party politician too. But don't read too much into that. Both of these men at times are effective battalion commanders. But the suspicion outside of 5 Brigade is, oh my goodness, they're the glamour boys, aren't they? 6 Brigade, 4 Brigade are commanded by lawyers. That seems to be a much happier proposition. And let's face it, Hargest has problems not only with command, he has problems with the resources at his control. This is his headquarters staff, including his battalion commanders. That is what he has to command 2,700 troops in battle. His brigade captain Mason, his brigade major Bob Dawson, who a lot of the responsibility falls on his shoulders, and some of his other staff, his transport officer, medical officer, and the like, the signals officer, they don't get on. This one, I think that one, keep fighting and having arguments in the wee small hours of the morning. 23rd Battalion, Faulkner, so he goes to another command, becomes a brigadier. His replacement is Leckie, we've mentioned. So already Hargest has a new battalion commander, or a returned battalion commander, to look after. 22nd Battalion still has Les Andrew. 21 Battalion has a new commander. And 28th Ngāri Battalion, of course, has George Dittmer, the Prussian. So he has untried people. Mason's a fairly new appointment. Bob Dawson, his brigade major, is a new appointment. He has new staff and a big battle coming up with the resources at his control. That's one problem. Another problem is his command relationship with Edward Puttick. They're connected by telephone. One reason Hargest stays at his headquarters in Batanias is there's a working telephone line to Hania. Puttick's on the other end as the divisional commander. Puttick is a micromanager. He will ring this man up at 2 in the morning to tell him about defensive arrangements with the anti-aircraft guns at Malamay Airfield when he's trying to get some sleep. He gets about 4 hours sleep before the battle opens on the 20th of May and writes in his diary, "I am not feeling very good this morning. Muzzy, I need a rest." Control. I mean, there's the battle plan again. Here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4 battalions, plus an engineer's detachment, plus a field punishment centre. Military prison. Quite a few Maori lads have got stuck into the wine in Platanias and got themselves into trouble. When battle breaks out, they're very effective fighters. It's really good to have them there, ironically, as it turns out. So that looks like a fairly organised battle plan. 22nd, as Hargis says, on the position of honour, 23rd to support, either to the coast or to 22nd Battalion as it needs it, 28th Maori Battalion capable of again defending the coast or coming up to help defend the airfield. Looks good on paper. In practice, and our next map comes from Comeau's Battle of Crete. He was an Air Force NCO, won the Distinguished Conduct Medal, I think, on Crete. It's one of the best accounts of Crete. Well, this is this Hill 107 we've looked at, where 22nd Battalion is in control. Well, you'd think so. There's the airfield just down by the sea. Here's the, what have we got? C Company, D Company, these are the 22nd Battalion positions, but scattered in amongst them, look at this. RAF position, right near the bridge. RAF camp, right near the bridge. There are naval guns. There's a Fleet Air Arm camp. There are other units stuck on the hill. There are Royal Naval guns operated by the Royal Marines. And further back is a radar unit operated by the Royal Air Force. Hargis has no control over these other units, including the anti-aircraft guns on the aerodrome. So he has only control over his infantry. Now, I'll show you shortly. That is actually a real problem, because here with the RAF campers, pretty much directly opposite the bridge over the Tavernitis River, so at the juncture between some of the 22nd Battalion units, you've got this Royal Air Force camp in the middle of things. Now, they're penguins. They're ground-proof. They're ergs. They don't fly. They don't particularly fight. They haven't been trained in any more than the basics. They also have an operational radio there that no one tells the army about. They have a radio link working back to Hania. When all the other signals fail, these guys have cobbled together very effective radio sets from wrecked aircraft on their own initiative. Hargis never knows that. They also have the code books there, which they don't remember to burn when they leave the camp, so the Germans capture those. Not very good luck. Hargis is constantly frustrated by that division, that break in command. He can't actually control all of the troops here on Hill 107. That's not Hargis, that's me. This is the Tavernitis Bridge. This is the German view. So we've got 22nd Battalion positions here, 21st Battalion up here. Right around here, you've sort of got the Air Force units. So they're the ones you're attacking first. It's a weak spot. Germans knew that in 1941. Things didn't go all their own way, of course. There's the Tavernitis Bridge from the German view in 1941. That's a crash glider. Just as an aside, the glider assault wasn't particularly successful. This is a riverbed with big rocks in it. You can't land a glider on big rocks and not expect the thing to turn turtle and break the necks of half the people inside. If I'm right, this is the glider which actually hit the supports of the bridge, bounced off, killed everyone inside but the photographer sitting right in the back. Some of the gliders came to rest under the guns of 22nd Battalion, even some of the RAF people, and some of the inhabitants, the nine troops, didn't make it out. Communications. The British had the venerable number 18 set, the backpack. Didn't have enough of them, didn't have enough batteries. They'd been left behind on Greece the month before. They also tried to rely on the Cretan telephone system. It's no better then than it is now in some ways. It's a Cretan card phone. There was one telephone line and one telephone exchange. And there was one platoon from 21 Battalion who were given the job of watching that bridge over the Tavernitis. They didn't have a radio. They were supposed to go to the local farm and ask if they could use their phone to ring back to Hania to then let Hargis know what was going on. Didn't work. What gets me, though, because the signals were so poor, they actually did this. They had beacons ready to light across the island when the German invasion happened, especially the seaboard side. Isn't that just smacking of the Spanish Armada? So really primitive communications on the British side. They used dispatch runners. Dispatch riders, they didn't survive very well in broad daylight with German fighter aircraft flying over every road. Just as soon as a plume of smoke goes up behind a motorbike or a brain gun carrier, that unit's effectively wiped out. On the German side, technology is a wonderful thing. The Germans had excellent radios. They had radio sets that worked well on Crete. They also worked well back to Athens. That's how Student could sit in that hotel back in Athens and receive frontline reports from his troops, from all of them, from Malea across to Heraklion, and understand where the fighting was going well and where it was going poorly. In addition, as soon as the battle starts, British access to Enigma, those German decodes, stops. So Freiburg doesn't get many more updates. I think it's one on the German battle as it develops from the German side. There is no real-time decryption of the German intercepts so that he can be updated and adapt his battle accordingly. On the German side, they have that capability. Some of these radio units are able to intercept the Allied radio traffic. Helps if you've got the code books, doesn't it? But they're able to intercept the Allied radio traffic and decrypt that in real time, so they can know what some of the local units are actually doing. And so, as I've said, the first stage of the first day of the battle, and the paratroop drops at Malene, down here near Galatos or in Prison Valley, one up here on the Akrotiri Peninsula, the airfields at Retimon and Heraklion. These are pretty much suppressed, especially at Retimon, also at Heraklion. The Germans do not have it their own way. The Australians here are particularly effective at knocking back the German aerial troops. Where things are in the balance, and this is where Student's radio communications come into play, he senses, even from Athens, that there's something wrong at Malena. The defences aren't as strong, or there's confusion. He senses there's something wrong. So the following morning, he details one of his pilots to take an aircraft down to the airfield, down by the beach, which, as far as he knows, is still occupied by the New Zealanders. But he has had reports that they're no longer on the hill. Sends that aircraft in, it's to be touch and go. Come in, land on the runway. If you're shot at, or if you're shot at and crash, well, don't come back. If you do manage to land unopposed, fly straight back. Let me know, and those troop transports or the mountain troops are ready to go. We'll start flying those things in as fast as we can. That, he knew, was the key point. Why did that happen? I like to think of it as a cascade of failures, if you like. Here at Hill 107, Kavkazia Hill, 22nd Battalion, they take the brunt of the force, both of the aerial assaults and the paratroop drops. By the evening, it's a story that is so well told, Colonel Andrew has attempted a counterattack on the airfield, and it's always a matter of too little too late. For a battalion, he's able to muster a platoon for a counterattack by Haddon Donald, and the tanks that they have, the British Matilda tanks. The tanks break down, and one heads off to the left to the river and is never seen again. And the troops are too few to try and push the Germans away from the airfield. So that counterattack fails. His pleas to the 23rd Battalion for assistance are not responded to by Leckie. And Hargest supports Leckie to hold his position, because the news that's coming back from here is things are under control, but we're still not winning the battle. 21 Battalion really doesn't take part in the battle here at the front. And the Maori Battalion are sort of essentially cooling their heels at Britannias. The evening of the 20th of May, Andrew makes the decision to consolidate his forces. As far as Hargest knows, the idea is to pull back and put a new defensive position in together. What actually happens is that Andrew decides to come off the hill completely, pull his troops off, much to their surprise, because they know that they're winning, they're in positions, they're comfortable. Link up the 23rd Battalion and try and reassess the following day. It's a fatal mistake, really, because it gives the hill, which commands the airfield, to the German forces, and the first Germans who get up to the top there really can't believe their luck. A company of Maori Battalion troops have been sent up to try and reinforce 22nd Battalion, get to the hill as well, and they can't believe the 22nd Battalion's left either. And a historian, Stewart, said there was a fateful quadrille, this wonderful dance at night with the Germans taking over the positions and some of the New Zealanders trying to figure out where are we, where should we be. And unfortunately, by the time sun breaks over the hill, it is essentially too late. We're to blame. Blame falls on everybody's shoulders, really. Andrew has been apportioned some blame. Some people blame Leckie. He may have had a breakdown in the middle of the battle. Who knows? I wasn't there, and thank God I wasn't. He was looking after his own troops here at Dashgaliana. Hargest, of course, was exhausted. He didn't have battle fatigue or battle shell shock, as people think, from the First World War. He was certainly way beyond the limits of his endurance. He was exhausted. His radio link from Platanias to here is fading. Those little number 18 sets, they don't have enough batteries. Andrew's last signal back to Hargest really is from a radio with the batteries that have died. And that's when he's saying, I have to sort of pull back and consolidate, and Hargest utters the fateful words, if you must, you must, and leaves the command decision with Andrew. The rest is history. Hargest does realise there's something going wrong up at 22nd Battalion, and he sends Bob Dawson, his brigade major, in a perilous trip by Bren gun carrier 5 miles up to here, at which point they realise Andrew himself is exhausted. Leckie is probably exhausted as well. And Harold Dittmer is, say, still pulling his heels at Platanias. At that point, really, the battle is turned towards the Germans. It's still on a knife edge. There's still a capability to have a counterattack and push the Germans back off the airfield at Maleme. But again, that field fails for a variety of reasons. From my perspective, Hargest picks himself together the following day, picks himself up, gets back some modicum of self-control, but he's still exhausted. He understands that there needs to be a counterattack, but he's waiting for forces to come from Brigade Reserve, from 4 Brigade, and that's right, isn't it? Yes. 4 Brigade, 20th Battalion, the like, to try and assist his counterattack. So again, it's a shortage of troops. Where a battalion's launching a counterattack, it's got a platoon. That night, when they are reinforced by other units, like 28th Maori Battalion, where they should have a battalion, they get a company. Where there's a counterattack by the New Zealand Division at Maleme, they involve a battalion, not a brigade. The fact is, there are too few troops available or committed at various points on these early days of the battle. Freyberg, from my perspective, reading Hargest's material, is quite remote up here in the Akrotiri Peninsula. His higher command of the battle doesn't seem to filter through to what's happening here, what the Germans would call the Schwerpunkt. Puttick, sceptical, micromanaging, he's actually, I think, somewhat of a block during the battle, and he's more worried about troops, Australian troops, taking over New Zealand positions before the New Zealanders can move, rather than just saying, for God's sake, get up there, get moving, get the counterattack going at night. We know the Germans don't like that. Retake the airfield. The urgency here. Leslie Engels, who's commanding the Brigade Reserve, is practically out of the battle at this point. He's always somewhere else. Hargest does accuse him of essentially cowardice, but we'll see how that comes out in the book. He redeems himself a little bit later in North Africa, but during Crete, not the best performer. A lot of it falls on the shoulder of Howard Kippenberger from Timaru, and he's here with a composite brigade around Galatas, and his performance in the battle is exceptional. So, of the command failures, Kippenberger's success stands out. It's these old World War I generals who don't seem to have the bite to go forward and actually turn the battle. It's left to the younger troops, as always, the younger Germans, and in this case, Roy Farron and his little tanks, which are sort of perambulators with some tinfoil wrapped around them. They've got little machine guns. They're reconnaissance vehicles. They're everywhere around Crete till they get knocked out one after the other. But it's a very hard-fought battle, as the casualties will show. But essentially, after the airfield falls, the tide of the battle turns the German way. The British at Heraklion become isolated. They are evacuated separately. The Australian garrison at Retimont, despite their sterling effort at repulsing the German attack, become prisoners of war. And it's left to the other units from Maleme to Hania and Suda Bay to then fight the Germans and fight an increasingly desperate rearguard action as they move south to be evacuated. In the course of the battle, of course, the fighting is hard. As James Hargest himself said, let me get the quote about his troops, and saying that they killed and hunted the Germans down like animals. And it really was that sort of hard-fought battle. That is how someone like Charles Upham wins his first Victoria Cross for his actions on Crete. That is how Hume wins his Victoria Cross as well, taking the Germans on at their own game. Yes? Goodness me. All right, we'll wrap this up in about a few minutes. It's a hard-fought battle. Let's keep going. There are some highlights for the counterattack on 42nd Street, just down off Hania near Suda Bay, where the bayonet comes into play, particularly 28th Maori Battalion troops. It's one of those battles where I could write a separate book on that and still not get to the truth. But suffice to say, the fact that the New Zealanders and other troops were able to pull themselves together and push the Germans back, even as late as the 27th of May, 7 days into the battle, was quite a feat of arms, and especially the bayonet. But then it became a retreat for the Allies through Brissus. Some were captured, the others were trying to make their way to an embarkation port on the south of Crete. Oristarchion, several thousand troops are evacuated successfully from Oristarchion towards the end of May and early June. What they don't realise, of course, is that the Germans are pulling out. They're directing their troops towards Russia. Their air force is needed for the preparations for Operation Barbarossa. So if the Allies, had they known it, Ultra lets them down, they actually had the breathing space. They're in the eye of the storm. They could have evacuated more troops from Oristarchion had they known it, risked more Allied warships to get the troops off. But as it is, the decision was made to halt the evacuations by a certain point. So the fighting from here, back to here, then across the White Mountains over to Slovakia. And you can see here 2,600 troops evacuated from the 28th to the 31st of May 1941, including Hargis and Fire Brigade. Okay. Getting there. Couple of minutes. Always look at the butcher's bill, which I'll just flip forward to. Did you write that down? Casualties. British Commonwealth troops, about 30,000 on the island, about 3,500 killed or missing, 12,000 taken prisoner of war. The Greeks, 544 killed in action, about 5,200 taken prisoners of war. Royal Navy lose 12 fleet ships, 7 auxiliary ships in the process of trying to evacuate troops from Crete, because they could work at night. If they caught in day, the Luftwaffe would get them. RAF lost 24 aircraft shot down, 12 still destroyed on the ground. Many at the airfield before the battle began. New Zealand, that equates to 671 killed, 2,180 prisoners of war. On the German side, there's an ME-109 just near Britannias. Their total casualties are over 3,000 troops, 3,500. Particularly aircraft, they lose 284 aircraft lost and 125 damaged. And when you consider a year later, they're trying to airlift supplies to Stalingrad, those missing troop transports which are lost during the Battle of Crete, that gap, they haven't been able to make enough planes to fill in the gap, becomes crucial. The Greeks, the Cretans in particular, still welcome New Zealanders to Crete. They appreciate that for those days in May, that New Zealanders, Australians, English, stood alongside the Cretans in trying to repulse the German invaders. The Cretans are very independent people, fiercely independent. They'd only gained their independence some 30 years earlier, and so they have a memorial there at Britannias, not far from where Hargis had his headquarters. And actually, the story of the German occupation of Crete is just as bloody as the battle. So during the years that the Germans occupied Crete, as many German soldiers are killed by the Cretans as died during the Battle of Crete, and as many Cretans are killed in reprisals as Allied troops died during the battle itself. It's a fierce, bitter, brutal memory. I will leave you on that note just and say, Ifaristo, thank you very much, and I'm happy to take a few questions if anybody has any.
Thanks, Ron. Are there any questions? We've got time for a couple. Yeah?
What was the duration of the battle proper? What was the duration of the battle?
Essentially 10 days, really, from 20th to the 30th of May.
by the 31st, evacuations are happening. The battle has stopped, and it's a rearguard action holding the Germans at bay, or the troops, as many Allied troops get off as they can for 10 days.
The Germans, I think, never used airborne troops again, is that right, as a
they
result of this?
They never used Germans in a massed airborne invasion, so you're right. The plan after Crete was to take Cyprus with airborne troops, and Hitler canned that, said, we will not waste our paratroops like that again. They did do limited parachute drops. There were limited parachute operations, but nothing on this scale was attempted until, essentially, the Allies invaded Normandy, or invaded Sicily and then Normandy. The Allies learned more from Crete than probably the Germans did. And so after this time, when you see paratroopers, Fallschirmjäger, show up in battles in Cassino or in Normandy, they're ground troops. They still happen to be elite ground troops.
Yeah.
What year did the Germans pull out of Crete?
45.
So there was an occupation.
There was an occupation of Crete.
Yeah.
So the Germans did occupy Crete. It was never a successful base for them. They had so many troubles with the locals. They should have learned from the Turks and the Venetians and the Byzantines before they arrived. They occupied Crete to a greater or lesser extent. I mean, if you've seen Ill Met by Moonlight, story of Moss, Stanley Moss and company, who kidnapped the German general, Kuba, from Crete, that's 1944, I think it is, 44. So the Germans are still there, and in fact, by 45, they were very happy to surrender. So the Allies arrive, and the Germans are actually given the job of guarding themselves at one stage. And the Germans actually asked to keep their weapons because they say, if we put in a pre-OW camp and there aren't enough guards, the Prussians are going to kill us. So please,
behave. Yeah, Chris.
Would you summarise Haga's performance on Crete? How would you say he performed?
Before the battle, he probably did the best with what he had. On those first days of battle, he might as well not have been there. Yes, he didn't have the grip that he needed. I think he was too tired, too out of it, and too reliant on subordinates to fight the battle for him. He did say it was a younger man's war, and he accepted the fact that as the battle progressed, it would become an individual soldier's battle. He accepted that, I think, rather than thinking we need to really cross the Germans. As the battle progressed, he picked himself up, pulled himself together, and his performance during those rearguard days when the forces were evacuated to Slovakia, I think he was performing exceptionally well then. But again, it was really making sure his own troops got off in a complete unit. But for those who worked with him, Vasey, the Australian brigadier at the time, he was no fool. He thought Hargis did pretty well, all things considered. But yes, overall, Hargis has to take some accountability for the loss of the battle in those first few days for a variety of reasons. Not being present, not making sure his commanders understood their role, not giving them effectively a kick up the backside in person when he knew things were wrong in front. I mean, he could sense it. But to say if you must, and then the battle develops, or the retreat from the hill develops, and things deteriorate from there. That's, and sending a brigade major instead of yourself, that's not command. That's nice.
Well, I think that's probably about all the time we've got for the presentation. It's a fascinating story, fascinating history. There have been quite a number of publications written on it, and it is worth a read, both the official histories, particularly of the units involved, as well as a number of other books that have been written by a range of military historians. It's worth reading. It's quite a tale, actually. And it's an incredible tale also of, the basic New Zealand soldier, and how they performed. Quite incredible. A lot of feats of bravery, a lot of hard-ass activities and so on.
In fact, if I could recommend a book while we're here at the library, Chris Paxley's Bloody Road Home. If you want Crete as a battle and in the context of the New Zealand Division of World War II, we'll start there.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, look, once again, put your hands together and thank Eric for great presentation that I know is very near and dear to your heart.